Hello, and welcome back to Ag Tech So What, brought to you by AgThentic. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. Today's guest is coming to us all the way from Canada. Evan Fraser joins me to talk first about ag tech adoption and three big barriers we need to overcome. And second, something many of you are probably wondering about. How will COVID-19 impact food and agriculture? All good superheroes have their origin stories. In ag, it's often how we got hooked on this industry. Evan starts out with his.
My origin story starts on my grandfather's fruit farm in Niagara. And I was probably 17 or 18 years old, and I remember the day very clearly. And my grandmother was actually a stockbroker. And so a female stockbroker married to a male farmer was anomalous enough at the time. This is the 1980s. And I remember Gran's Lincoln Town Car sliding into the driveway and the power window coming down and the puff of air conditioned atmosphere coming out. And I'd spent the entire day on my hands and knees pulling weeds out of the strawberry patch. And my grandmother and I, you know, exchanged pleasantries for a few minutes and said hello and whatnot. And it quickly became clear that she had made more money on commission from her clients' investment portfolios that afternoon than I was going to make producing food all summer. And a couple of key conclusions sprung into my mind at that moment. The first of all is, wow, the world's a weird place when being a stockbroker is so much more valuable to society and remunerative to society than producing food. And I never want to be a farmer myself. Way easier to write about farming and talk about it than it is to actually trying to make a living off of a fruit and vegetable farm in the Niagara Peninsula.
From there, Evan was sold on food and agriculture. But his path to where he is now had a few twists and turns across a couple of different industries along the way.
Yeah, well, you know, to be honest, it didn't take any time for me to be fully into the space because that was the common denominator ever since being a teenager, you know, spending summers as a teenager with grandpa on the farm. Food and ag has always been my passion, although how I've come at it has changed a lot over my career. So I actually have an undergraduate degree in anthropology, Celtic studies and religion. And my fourth year thesis was all about the Irish potato famine and why a quarter of Ireland's population, about 2 to 4 million people, were either died or displaced because one crop failed. I then did work on, have a master's degree in forestry. I've got a PhD in agriculture. My first postdoc, after my agriculture degree, I did a postdoc in basically an international relations division, working for cabinet ministers. It was essentially a policy think tank. And then I got a job with an atmosphere chemistry group talking about climate change in England. And now I'm directing a interdisciplinary institute focused on the future of food called the Arrol Food Institute at the University of Guelph in Canada.
Evan is doing some really cool stuff at the Arrol Food Institute. He supervised dozens of grad students on everything from food riots to climate smart agriculture to the role of supermarkets in alternative protein consumption. He's the author of 2 books and the creator of a card game on the food system. And he's produced a series of animated videos on agriculture that have been viewed over 500,000 times. All of these, of course, are linked in the show notes. So Evan knows a lot about what's happening in the world and is excited about the potential of ag tech.
Well, if we look at the 21st century with the various challenges that we face, population growth, climate change, the spread of infectious diseases, diabetes and obesity, a large number of those in some ways track back or trace back to food and the food systems that we depend on for life. And I firmly believe that solving the challenge of global food security for the 21st century is one of the critical challenges that the history books of this century will have significant chapters written about food and food systems. Mm-hmm. Within that challenge, though, comes what is arguably one of the most incredible opportunities facing the planet. And that is that we have novel technologies, which go from genomic technologies all the way through to big data and artificial intelligence. We have a flood of capital moving into this sector with interest as an investment opportunity. We have a focusing of government agendas on food as something that can deliver economic benefit, but also serve up a pathway towards achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. So I think we face this extraordinary opportunity as well. By deploying technology, by investing in people, by working with farmers, by establishing policy and regulatory frameworks to actually generate a tremendous amount of public and economic good at the same time as solving one of the greatest sustainability and public health challenges we face.
But despite this potential, there's still a lot of hype out there about ag tech. Just a couple weeks ago, I ran a workshop with a group of Nuffield scholars from all around the world. And when I asked them to vote on whether ag tech is hype or reality, I'd say still about 40% voted for hype. I asked Evan what he's seeing in his work.
So starting at the sort of the super macro perspective, I don't think it's hype. I think it's real. The demand for food is rising. The need to change food systems is very, very evident. And to a large extent, agriculture is, as a sector of the economy, undercapitalized and underinvested in for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. So there is an opportunity for, so at a macro level, what we've got is a part of the economy for which there's demand for the product, and there hasn't been a lot of investment at a global level compared with other sectors of the economy. So we should be able to put money in technology, in agriculture, and realize some significant gains. But really at that macro level, that's not where farmers benefit or there's a decent return on investment. What you have to get to is what the barriers and the bottlenecks are.
There are three big barriers to ag tech adoption that Evan sees for the developed world. One, data interoperability. Two, data governance. And three, cybersecurity.
So the three things that I think need to be worked on with significant urgency to realize ag technology is one, data interoperability. And we need our data that is driving this new digital food economy to be sitting together and playing nice. And that is an enormous challenge. As anyone that's tried to figure out how to get a smart home to work and your phone to work with your refrigerator, to work with your TV, to work with your coffee maker, I mean, and your thermostat and your light switches and stuff, it is so difficult to get that sort of Internet of Things technology to actually work as promised. And that often results in a data interoperability problem. So there's a tremendous amount of challenges on this area of data interoperability. Second, we've really got to be thinking about data governance. Who owns data? How do we secure privacy? How do we maintain anonymity? How do we give farmers a share in the benefits of data? And until we figure out the data governance questions, the digital agricultural revolution will forever remain a mirage. And the third area is that I think we need to work on hard is cybersecurity. And I get terrified by the prospect of cyber criminals hacking into, say, a poultry barn and turning off the ventilation system and holding the ventilation system as ransom for Bitcoin.
Holding a farm ransom for Bitcoin might seem a bit outrageous, but Evan's concerns here come from good examples in other industries.
Well, I started thinking about this almost 2 years ago when doctors and nurses across England went into their offices in the national health system 2 years ago and sat down at the terminals to pull up patient health files, and they'd been attacked overnight by a piece of ransomware called WannaCry. And these cyber criminals were holding patient records hostage to ransom for the national health system. And that tied the national health system up or shut it down for some number of days. Well, a poultry farmer with a ventilation on their barn can't shut themselves down for a few days, or a dairy farmer with a robotic milker can't go dormant for even 12 or 24 hours. Those cows need to be milked on a schedule. So I think there's tremendous cybersecurity threats that we're opening ourselves up to. So if we think about the sort of the digital agriculture revolution, we've got to work on the data interoperability, the cybersecurity, and the data management and governance, or it will remain in hype world.
You're speaking the language of many of the farmers that I believe listen to this podcast and that I know I speak to. The interoperability challenge for sure is the number one that comes up. You know, my this system doesn't talk to my that system, and why would I adopt
exactly,
this? Because, yeah, you know, I just can't get data from here to there. And so what's the point?
Well, I'm going to argue by analogy first. And to me, this is a Y2K style problem. So, you know, going back in time 30 years, everyone was worried that when the clocks hit January 1st, 2000, the planes would drop out of the air and the computers would stop running and the stock markets would crash, etc. And in anticipation of that, there was a massive international effort to create code, essentially computer code, that would harmonize those sort of issues. Now, we're not worried in this case about planes falling out of the air, but maybe we should be. I think that there needs to be a similar sized mobilization at the international level to deal with data interoperability, much like we did 25 years ago in the lead up to the Y2K situation. And so I think that the natural place where this solution is going to be found is international, but it's going to require a coalition of public, private, and academic NGO partners to actually achieve it.
It's such an interesting one because the Y2K example, I remember I was, my dad was like, yeah, we'll get a 6-pack of beer, a bottle of milk, and a video. It was a, you know, an actual VHS at the time, and we'll be fine. It's like, well, he's not worried, so maybe it will be fine. But that's a, you know, the fear of what could happen and the size of that challenge catalyzes people to get involved and collaborate and do things they otherwise wouldn't do. Do you think we'll need some kind of similar shake to the system to solve the data interoperability, or we'll find a way to collaborate without that?
Well, I mean, I would like to think that we're smart enough as a species to figure out ways of collaborating because it's a good thing as opposed to it just avoids a bad thing. You know, I guess in a sense, your question, Sarah, seems to be, are you pessimistic and optimistic about humans' ability to forward plan? And for the sake of being optimistic in this somewhat gloomy point of history, I'm going to say I'm optimistic we can do that. But we need to put our shoulders to the wheel or the nose to the grindstone in order to do that. And I don't think that we will get the benefits of the so-called digital agriculture revolution until we do this.
I sure hope Evan is right. I know some great organizations are already working on this, maybe a topic for a future podcast. But for the other two challenges, data governance and cybersecurity, what is Evan seeing in terms of solutions?
Well, data governance is being picked up at a sort of a theoretical level by some key organizations. I know there's out of the big agriculture university of Wageningen in the Netherlands is taking a leadership on this. There's the organization called GODAN, Global Organization for Data for Agriculture and Nutrition, which is trying to establish some core principles. And really, it's the data question that we're facing in all sectors of the economy, whether it's Uber or Amazon or Facebook stealing our data and using it for profit motives, and the people who produce the data feeling disenfranchised and alienated that they're being taken advantage of. I think it's that data writ large. And again, that's going to have to come, or that's the solution to that is going to come out of an international collaboration to, I think, establish fair use principles around data, which involves benefit sharing. In other words, if you produce data and it goes into a cloud and then an app developer uses that data to create a decision support tool that makes your job easier, all the participants in that chain need to have some way of sharing the benefits. So that's one thing that has to be worked on. And you can establish protocols around benefit sharing. Similarly, people are suspicious that if they give up their data to the cloud for this big data revolution, they'll also be giving up privacy and anonymity and things of that nature. And again, there's protocols that can be established that are becoming established that can address those issues. Things like the data can be used, but all the metadata has to be cleaned from it such that you can't trace it back to an individual farmer, for instance, or other things like that. We just have to do that sort of, have that conversation, empower the agencies to have that discussion and create some regulations around it.
Our team, I guess, have kind of put the challenge for farmers or the fear for farmers into three buckets. And it's a really challenging one because it limits adoption because of some of these real and perceived issues. But one is, you know, I can't get my data, or I can't use it, or I can't move it from system to system. The second is that someone else will benefit from the data. And the third is that actually harm will come to me. And those are kind of escalating levels of fear, but all of them prevent, you know, adoption of some of these tools that can otherwise be helpful.
Yep. Sounds like we're on very convergent paths in our own little sort of mental journeys on this topic. So I would agree with that. And until we deal with those fears and those anxieties, we won't have the benefits of the digital ag revolution that we're all so excited about.
At the University of Guelph, Evan is involved in some Canadian initiatives to bring the right stakeholders together to help solve these challenges for farmers. But as we often talk about on this podcast, bringing folks together from in and outside of agriculture can be challenging.
So in the Canadian context, you know, a key stakeholder would be some private sector players such as IBM or Cisco that actually have the technological expertise to do the data management. But equally, you'd need to have the Canadian Federation of Agriculture in the room in order to speak for the farmers' voices. And you'd need a few academics like me that has a sense of the big picture. And I'm useless on the details, but at least I can understand where the different groups are coming from. And then you'd have to work through in a very deliberate and patient way navigating all the issues that would start with, well, boy, we're all speaking different languages here. So, you know, we use the same words, but we use them in different ways. So there's a translation problem to have that conversation. all the way through to, okay, what part of these series of recommendations this conversation would result in? What part of it should actually be formal regulations that the government says you have to do this? What part of these are simply principles of best practice that we, industry and the players, agree to adhere to? And it becomes, I mean, for purposes of this podcast, it becomes a very boring, long-winded, dry process. But it's those boring, long-winded, and dry processes that I think result in both the cultural change and the community of understanding that we need, as well as the sort of the formal regulations and laws to govern these things.
I love the common language challenge. I use that a lot. Maybe you have some good examples that I can steal. I talk about AI being, you know, artificial intelligence or artificial insemination. Pivot is a good one because, you know, a center pivot versus
pivot irrigation versus pivoting to address something.
That's another. Ecosystem tends to have different meanings. Incubator is another one. I don't know. Do you have any I can add to my list?
Oh, that's a good question. And I'm jamming on it right now. But there were three AIs where I was in a room. And one person thought it was artificial intelligence. One person thought it was artificial insemination. Somebody thought it was something or other else. And we were just staring at each other, baffled, because no one understood what was going on in the conversation.
I could nerd out with Evan pretty much all day on ag tech adoption, but I wanted to ask him about something completely different. Something where his experience and expertise on the history of agri-supply chains and the challenges we faced as a civilization would come in handy. COVID-19. How will the coronavirus pandemic impact agriculture?
Well, it's so interesting. And I think I can't speak for the experience in Australia, but I certainly was shocked when I went to the grocery store last weekend and for the first time in my life saw empty shelves. And boy, you look at an empty shelf and you can't help but think about the zombie apocalypse. And you're thinking, am I about to be living through the zombie apocalypse or the plague apocalypse or whatever it is? It has felt like an apocalyptic week. And I think we have to acknowledge the extraordinary anxiety that being confronted with empty shelves presents in people.
Just for a time check, as things are changing rapidly around the world, we recorded this episode on Friday, March 20th, Canada time. Many Australians were still out and about. But in Canada, things were quite different.
I live just outside of Toronto, Ontario, and we essentially are leaving the house to walk the dog, leaving the house to go grocery shopping. That's about it. I'm getting out for a run, but I'm not running with my group anymore. I'm just running on my own. The group has been disbanded. You know, at the university, all face-to-face meetings have been stopped. All staff have been told to work at home. My colleagues are working on protocols for animal care because we're an ag college, so we've got lots of animals that we're caring for, both laboratory and experimental, and just we have a working dairy barn. So how to staff that when the university is in lockdown these are non-trivial issues. And the phenomenon of empty shelves has hit Canadians very hard in the last week. With that being said, our demand for food hasn't fundamentally changed. We saw a spike in food purchases last week, but our demand for food, you know, the same number of meals is being eaten in Canada this week as it was 2 weeks ago. So I have every expectation that our food system is robust enough to deal with this kind of shock, and that with the exception of a few products, perhaps like hand sanitizer, we will see the grocery store shelves filling back up almost immediately. And my brother works at a grocery store, and I texted him this morning and he said, yep, there's a few things that we're low on, but pretty much it's back to business as usual. Although we're restricting the number of people that come into the grocery store at a time, and we're only operating every other cash to keep people physically distant from themselves. And they're shutting early so that they can sanitize everything every night. Some significant disruptions, but I don't think cause for panic. And I don't think anybody is necessarily going to need to go hungry as a result of a shortage. Of course, for a person, you know, Canada is a country with 4 million food insecure people, many of whom are in precarious employment situations. I worry that many of those people may have lost their jobs in the last week because the service sector has essentially shut down and there's been mass layoffs for restaurants and bars, because essentially all restaurants and bars are closed, all theaters are closed, all venues are closed. And so all those people who depend on those sources of those places for their wages are without wages. So I think there may be a food insecurity crisis, but it's not associated with what's on the grocery store shelves and the lack of stuff on the shelf, it's associated with people losing their people who are already precariously employed losing their jobs.
Hmm. Yep. And you said in a recent post you wrote that we'll link in the show notes, the first thing is don't panic, you know, despite these challenges and how easy that is to say but hard to do, that obviously keeping the mood calm is one of the first keys. Yeah, hopefully you haven't been seeing too much panic actually out there, but I'm sure there is some.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's anxiety. I don't think there's panic, at least in the stuff that I'm observing. Like I said, where I am worried from a food systems perspective in terms of people going hungry is actually loss of wages, not empty supermarket shelves. Yeah, so recommendation to all my fellow Canadians or anybody living through a period such as this is don't panic that the groceries aren't going to be there next week if you show up with your cart.
Beyond the hoarding and supermarket behavior we've all seen and the massive challenges that small businesses across sectors are facing, Evan sees some longer-term impacts for agriculture.
I think there's some interesting longer-term things that may cause the food system to adjust in the medium to longer term. And one of them is labor. And I think, I mean, I don't know about Australia, but for instance, in Canada, much of the labor in the horticulture industry, the fruits and vegetables, the produce sector, is done with temporary foreign workers that come in for periods of time, either from Central America or the Caribbean, is where in Ontario most of the foreign labor comes in. And they stay for a few months and they prune our apple orchards and they pick our strawberries and whatnot. And boy, I think we have to question the longevity of that program. Minister of Agriculture has reassured farmers that that will continue and that we will continue to bring in the temporary foreign workers. And I believe last year there was about 60,000 people that came in on temporary foreign worker programs to work on farms in Canada. So it's a big number of people. But I think that one of the legacies of COVID-19 might be a reflection on whether that is a system that we should be relying on. And if we say no to that system, that will, I think, trigger a lot of problems for horticulture and produce, fruit and vegetable farmers. And having studied the history of these sort of things in the past, automation and consolidation of farms is often the answer. So, for instance, in California, about 50 years ago, they restricted migrant labor coming into California to the tomato industry. And a lot of small tomato growers in California went out of business and sold out to bigger growers who invested in automation, you know, mechanical harvesters. So often automation in agriculture comes through shortages of labor. And if we are dependent on migrant labor and decide we're not going to use migrant labor in the future, there might be a wave of consolidation in the produce sector. Hmm. And that's already underway. We know farm numbers are declining and farm size is increasing. So that's not a new phenomenon, but it could accelerate that phenomenon. Hmm. And I think that could be a big deal for a lot of producers. I also think it could be a big deal for families in the Caribbean and Latin America who come up to Canada every year for a few months for wages.
The third big impact that Evan sees is perhaps more of a philosophical consideration.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, and really I'm sticking my neck out here and speaking from my own personal anxiety. So maybe I'll change my tune in 2 weeks' time once the dust is settled on all this. But my where I've been thinking in the last 24 or 48 hours as this story has sort of enveloped us all is, to what extent do we want to depend on, is it appropriate to depend on, is it desirable to depend on, is it safe to depend on a system that requires essentially the seamless movement of goods and labor to keep us fed? And I'm not, absolutely not saying that we should all become 100% locavores. I love the benefits that international trade brings us in terms of cost and convenience and a variety of diets and all that stuff. I'm a big fan. But maybe one of the legacies of COVID-19 and this and the spring of 2020 will be a reflection on what is the right balance of local, regional self-sufficiency and global trade in both labor, but I mean labor and food and technology. And is there sort of a portfolio that we should be aiming for, as opposed to saying, you know, we're all one or all the other? What's the right blended portfolio to maintain resilience alongside efficiency in our global food system? And I honestly don't have an answer for that one, because I'm speculating from a philosophical perspective. But my intuition is that perhaps we will think of the food system of the 2010s as overly globalized and therefore vulnerable to shocks. Hmm. And maybe we will reinvigorate regional food systems as a result. Hmm. Like I said, I'm working through these ideas in my mind. I'm not coming up with a firm pronouncement.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you sharing those early thoughts with us, Evan. I've definitely seen a few kind of hardcore ag economists and experts saying, oh, you know, maybe that brushing off of local food, you know, makes less sense than I thought it did. So I've seen a few people in this last week kind of reconsidering that balanced food system. And it's definitely something we believe technology also can help, that there'll be a range of food systems and farm production systems, small and large and local and global, and that's probably a more resilient system overall, which, you know, maybe this shock catalyzes some of that in the future.
Well, that's a really interesting point. And I'm going to riff on that, what you just said there, Sarah, for a second. If you go back to the Green Revolution, I mean, the technologies of the Green Revolution were really, in my mind, all about homogenization. You know, can you create a massive economy of scale by doing essentially exactly the same thing with the same genomics, with the same tractor over an enormous area? And it was a one, you know, really Green Revolution technologies are a one size fits all kind of management strategy. Whereas I would say that smart tractors, digital technologies, precision agriculture, it's all about managing variation. It's about changing, responding to things on a range of different scales, planting the right seed in the right point in the field and giving it the right amount of fertilizer as the promise of a smart tractor or a robotic milker that allows the cow to milk herself when she wants it, as opposed to sort of on a schedule that's prescribed by the farmer, or using accelerometers to determine when the cow goes into heat so that they can breed themselves, as opposed to using hormones to make them breed them on a schedule. I mean, I think that one of the benefits of the digital ag revolution, which I hope we realize, and I hope isn't hype, getting back to our early part of our conversation, is the ability to do farming at a range of scales and in a far more bespoke way in near real time on a meter by meter basis for each manage each plant and animal as individuals. And that might give us a huge amount more diversity and, by to your point, resilience in the system. And so if anything I'm hoping comes out of this is maybe we catalyze that kind of embracing of diversity that's enabled then by these digital technologies. And wouldn't that be a good outcome?
We all need a bit of positive news right now, so we'll leave it there with Evan Fraser, just after he takes me up on the opportunity for a shameless plug of what he's up to and where you can find more about him.
Yeah, well, happy to have the opportunity to do some self-promotion. ArrelFoodInstitute.ca, that's ARRELL, ArrelFoodInstitute.ca is the interdisciplinary institute that I am the director of. I also curate a series of educational resources, including a card game and a graphic novel and a series of lectures, etc., on a website called feeding9billion.com. So that's feeding9billion. And we have a YouTube channel as well where you can get access to me or track me down on Twitter on feeding9billion.
Awesome, Evan. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this, and really appreciate it. And stay safe out there.
Yep, same to you. And I'm happy to talk at any point.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of AgTech So What. You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.